Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening. I would like to welcome you, world, to the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk Radio Show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennett, and I'm from Bellevue, Washington. I have the privilege of being your host this evening. And tonight, our type of show is special guest night, and we have a very special guest with us this evening. And as you know, all of our guests are very special. Her name is Holly Kenley, and she's from Rancho Mirage, California. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist and a California state licensed teacher. And I'll tell you a little bit more about Holly when I read a little bit more of her bio before we bring her on. I wanted to mention it's scan number 2726. This is Monday, August 16th, 2021. Before I talk to you a little bit more about Holly, I wanted to talk to you about NASCA, because at NASCA, Child Abuse Trauma Prevention, Intervention, and Recovery, we have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone, and the second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, such as this talk show, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And if you're streaming in and you are intrigued and may want to join the show as a panel member, I would highly encourage you to do so. I'm going to be on the panel. The number to call in and participate in the panel is area code 646-595-2118. So again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. And since I am the sole host on the show this evening, if you do call in and I see your number pop up, I'll state the area code and the first three digits of your number. I will not state the last four digits to keep your confidentiality and anonymity if you wish to have it. And I'll invite you in when we break to the panel during the show. We normally break twice and offer you an opportunity to have a comment or ask our special guest a question related to their story. If you wish just to continue listening, it's perfectly fine to say so. So with that being said, I wanted to talk a little bit about how the show is structured on Special Guest 8-Minute Show. And it may sound like a long time, but it goes by very quickly. And on Special Guest Night, our special guest has an opportunity to tell their story. And we do so chronologically through life. So the show is broken up into three segments. The first segment is from the earliest memory from birth or early childhood up to about the age of 18. We'll then break to the panel for a first time, and our panel will have an opportunity to ask the guest a question or comment, again, regarding the guest story. We then go to the middle segment, which is the middle years from about 18 to 30. We'll break again to the panel. And at the end, the last segment is really some of the healing process. Sometimes that goes in the second segment. And what the guest is, the work that they're doing in the present day and possibly their plans for the future. So that's how the show is structured. As you know, we do archive our shows. So right after the show is over, I end the episode. The episode will be archived, and you can go in, anybody can go in, and listen to scan number 2726 at their leisure. And that's how we structure them. We try to, believe it or not, the archive shows. We've done them, as you can see, 3,000 of them. We do see people go in. We have survivors go in and listen to them over and over and over again. It helps. It helps people that may be contemplating or somewhere on their journey of recovery. So right before I bring Holly in, and I can see, Holly, we have a growing panel of support for you. We have Ken Lakin from Colorado. We have Bill Murray, the founder and CEO of NASCA. I welcome them both on. And before we move on, I want to talk to our listening audience, to our panel members, a little bit about Holly Kemley. As I mentioned, she's from Rancho Mirage, California. And she holds a master's degree in psychology, as I mentioned, and is also a licensed teacher. She currently works in the field of psychology as a speaker and a workshop presenter. And I'm going to stop there because we have a lot more show to go through, and I can read you bits and pieces of her bio. I don't want to give it all away. It's her story. But she's obviously doing some very, very good work, and I'm really just excited to have her on tonight. So, Holly, I'm going to unmute your mic, and I'm going to welcome you in. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Penelope, yes. Thank you so much for having me, and I am so looking forward to this. As we talked just briefly before, I've listened to several episodes, and I'm just so honored your work and what you do at NASCA, and it's so needed, obviously, as you've alluded to, and just so honored to be here and to share my story and the healing as well as the brokenness, too.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really do want to thank all of our guests for coming on the show. But, you know, in terms of special guest night, when you share your story, I always feel like there's it's a gift, because a gift we're giving ourselves, obviously, but by sharing your story, so many people listen, and even though our stories might be different, a lot of times the feelings are the same, and we don't feel like that we're alone when we hear other people tell their stories and share these similar experiences and feelings. And I think also there's a little bit of pain that goes along with recalling those past experiences, and that's why we feel it's a gift too, because, you know, we're willing to go through that pain to move forward in the healing process. So I think it takes a lot of courage, and I just want to acknowledge that, having you on the show and having you come on and telling us the personal side, right, of your own story. So with that being said, and I hope I'm coming through clearly, because my phone has been acting up a bit. Am I coming through clearly?
It breaks up just a little bit here and there, but I'm doing okay. So okay. But thank you, Penelope, for just mentioning that. So if I do lose you, I'll just let you know, or if I couldn't hear the full sentence or something.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, you know, if you wouldn't mind, you know, if you can, we're just going back, and I, you know, maybe sharing your earliest memory or giving us a little bit of context of the family that you were born into, the family of origin, you know, what life was like, you know, was there, what the family unit looked like, just some context and background and some of your earliest memories, and maybe just, you know, at your own comfort level and at your own pace, talking about your childhood up to the years of 18.
I would welcome doing that, and I do think the context, thank you for saying that, Penelope, because I think the context is so important. So I will start with that I was born into an alcoholic family system to very young parents who I believe were ill-equipped to raise a family, and the nature of the environment, and I'm remembering back as far as about, I can remember back to about 3 or 4. It was rigid, authoritarian, emotionally unsafe, unpredictable, and I would even use the word chaotic at times, in that there was just this, as I said, unpredictability, especially around the drinking. I was born in the 50s, so I'm older, and I just share that because our family kind of just always, it was the highball hour, as it was called, would start in the late afternoon or early evening. My father was a music teacher by profession, and that was not his profession of choice. He wanted to be a professional musician, and I think he felt denied that, and because my mom was in nursing school in Idaho, he was in college in Southern California, and they met up obviously at some time, and my mom pregnant, and they needed to get married, and of course back then that was a bit, you know, more of a scandal than it might be today, but they got married. I don't think they ever really wanted, or at least my father didn't plan on getting married. So I share that because there was just a lot of anger from him. And then when the highball hour started, things just got a lot worse. So I remember from a very young age just sensing that lack of safety and just kind of walking on eggshells, trying not to disrupt or disturb. I remember my mom being, and this is important to my story, I remember her being protective of us, and that would be, I'm the second of 4 daughters. So my older sister and I remember her being a loving mother when we were little, and I just remember her playing with dolls with us and being attentive. She was very much a victim of my dad's verbal abuse, especially when he would drink. Then one of my younger sisters was born when I was 4, and I remember things getting more tense. Finances were really tight, and just the stress and the tension in the family was increasing. And when I was 6, my youngest sister was born, and that's when things really shifted. I know that my father was very, very angry about my mother's pregnancy. Not that he didn't have anything to do with it, but he was just very angry, and that there was just a huge shift at that point in time. And I felt a huge detachment from my mother. My youngest sister, today I would think that because of what I know, she was probably somewhere on the spectrum, maybe mildly autistic. I don't know, but it's just something I've pieced together as I've looked back. But she was a very, very difficult baby, and she had health issues from the get-go, and so there was already all this tension and everything, and then with the birth of this youngest sibling, things really, really amped up. And one of the things, Penelope, that changed, my mother became very harsh in her punishments, and of course we were spanked. That was just something that was done then, or at least it was in our household. And when I was, my older sister and I, if we were perceived as disrespectful or talking back, my mom would give us the choice of having either our mouths washed out with soap or peppered. And I was a very shy, sensitive child. I was very compliant. I'm not saying I wasn't perfect, but I was that second typical people pleaser, peacemaker, wanting everybody to, you know, be happy. And so I really don't remember speaking back, but that's really not the point. She would carry out this ritual of taking us to this bathroom sink, and I remember standing on a little stool. And I've often thought over the years, Penelope, you know, it's not the worst kind of child abuse, but there's something about having your mouth, you know, I tried pepper, and pepper just burned for the longest period of time. So I think I only did that once, and then from then on, I chose to have it washed out with soap. Already, it wasn't safe to speak, and I mean, literally at our dinner table, nobody spoke. The four children did not speak. We were seen and not heard. But there was something about that ritual that really, really impacted me. And so I do share that openly because really as important as far as how I did my healing and where I ended up later in my career. So I just wanted to make sure I touched upon that. Another memory that I have, and so everything is ongoing as far as the stress and the overwhelm and the upset, is that we used to spend our summers with my grandparents in a little town in Nevada, kind of in the northeastern part of Nevada called Ely. And those were actually some of the happier times in our lives because my grandparents were well off and they could provide us with things that we didn't have. Well, anyway, we would typically go to the horse races in the summer. And for some reason, I to this day cannot imagine why, is that we were sitting there in our little booth in the, or the box in the horse races. My grandparents had their own little box. And I announced that I wanted to go home, go back to my grandparents' house, which was several miles away and down a very busy highway. And, you know, I don't know why I kept insisting it. And I remember then my mother turned around and said, if you want to go, you're going to have to walk. And my grandparents weren't there that day. They were back home. I think I just wanted to be with them. So I got up and I left. And again, I'm only, I think, about eight. And there was this huge dirt parking lot before you could ever get to the highway. And I made it almost to the highway, and I heard my mom yelling for me. And I turned around, and of course, she was, you know, worried as she saw me headed towards. So I started to head back towards her, and she caught up with me. And she had a kind of a bag or a purse in her hand, and it was kind of hard. And I had on a little dress. And she beat me all the way back to where the car was. It was horrific. And I just remember every time she beat me with that bag or with her hand, I just remember feeling her hatred. That's, you know, that's the way I interpreted it, is it was just raw anger and hatred in the things that she was saying to me. And she took me to the car, and then she took me home, back to my grandparents' house, and just dropped me off, and then she went back to the horse races. And my grandparents were there, and I came in, and they were pretty shocked, and my grandmother took me up the stairs and put me in the bath and, you know, kind of tended to me, but didn't say anything, really. Nothing was said. These were my dad's parents. Anyway, those are two instances that really, really stand out even to this day, obviously, along with all of the other stressors. And then at age 11, I was over at a neighbor's house just across the street, actually. And we were there. It was an older female, a teen female, and she was much bigger. I think she was a year or two older than me, but she was so much bigger than I was and heavier, and I was very small and petite for my age. And we were playing tag, and that tag turned into a game of attacking me, assaulting me, throwing me to the ground, and her being on top of me, ripping my clothes off, and sexually assaulting me for some time. I don't remember how long. I was eventually able to get away, kind of squirm out from underneath, and I ran home. My clothes are all torn, half on, half off. And my mom was at the kitchen sink, and I ran up to her sobbing, crying, and I told her what happened, and she just completely dismissed it and told me to go to my room and change my clothes and to never speak of it again. And so it was interesting, Penelope, by that time, and I can pull this up today. I see myself in my bedroom that I shared with one of my younger sisters, is that I knew at that point that I was on my own. I remember saying that to myself, that I don't understand everything that's going on here. I know it's not right. Because I had friends that had, especially two girlfriends in particular, who had very loving families, and I would spend time there and make this comparison going back and forth. But I made myself two promises at that point in time at age 11. And the first promise that I made myself was that I was going to do whatever it took so that when I graduated from high school, I could go away to college. I saw that as my avenue out. And so I was already a good student, and I was into music and being successful there. But that was it. I set my mind to it. And the other thing that I promised myself is that if I ever had the privilege of being a mother, that I would do it differently. Mm-hmm. And so the only other thing that really, that sexual trauma, and then I'll just jump forward just a little bit, a couple years later, is the second sexual trauma that happened, keeping in mind that all, the stress at home is still ongoing and increasing, and my younger sister is, the youngest one, is, again, always ill. My mother is completely and totally enmeshed and attached to her at the neglect of the three of us, the older three. At 13, I was once again put in harm's way, and my parents arranged for me to go and spend a month in the summer with some cousins that lived in another state. And I'll just put out there that they lived on a ranch far away from any town, so that when I explain this, there was no place to go for help. So I knew of these cousins. I had spent some time with them here and there, but nothing, long-term or anything. So it was sort of scary to be sent away for this month. And this is a time where I don't go into graphic detail because it's still very painful as far as calling it all up. And I'll tell later how I addressed it and worked through those wounds. But the whole family was just very deviant and disturbed. My uncle, he wasn't really my uncle, but he was called my uncle, was, I'm sure he was a sexual predator. There was just a lot of exposure to things that were just deviant and disturbing. His son, who was a high schooler at that time, was the same. There was a lot of voyeurism and exposing of themselves and just horrific stuff. And so there were two kids, the older male son, who was, like I said, a teenager in high school, and then they had a daughter who was my age. And there were things that she was perpetrated, and I was forced to watch and things like that. And then when I was left alone with her, there were days where we were just out on the ranch alone, she was also assaulting me. So there was just this, I called it, you know, the house of horrors. And my aunt they were all alcoholics as well. It was just horrific. And my aunt, I think, knew what was going on. And she was physically abusive to her daughter and emotionally and psychologically abusive to us. So the two of us were kind of like the scapegoats in that whole system. But it was just a horrific summer. So I come home. Well, it was a month, about a month long. I come home. And, of course, I didn't say anything to anybody because of what I had learned before. No one was going to believe it, wanted to hear it, or would do anything about it, even if, you know, I did share. So I just really repressed that, stuffed it, and went about my way. I was even more determined to do whatever I needed to do to be successful and graduate and go away to college.
Are you okay if we break here? Because we're about almost 30 minutes.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And I'm catching my breath because I'm just, you know, I guess no child deserves to experience and to live through any of those things and to live in that kind of an environment. And as I'm hearing your story, I just feel like I can hear, of course, a lot of it's hitting home for me. Just so many different layers and levels of abuse and neglect. And before I break to the panel, we have a very, very robust panel that's grown since we started, by the way. You've got a lot of support on the line. But I just, you know, as I'm hearing about, you know, do you want the soap? Do you want your mouthwash? Or do you want the pepper? To me, what strikes me about that is that growing up with you know, physical abuse in the home, just you knew the anticipation of that to me was worse than knowing what was coming and then knowing going through the event, right? Just that anticipation, right? And I can hear, you know, I mean, I don't tell you this because you're a professional, but, you know, we are frozen, right? We're not even fight or flight. Mm-hmm. We're just frozen, right? And it just that I think it keeps going on and on and on. The more that we're, you know, the more we're subjected to, we don't unfreeze, right? We completely start disconnecting because we're so frozen. But I've heard it, not just the anticipation of that. And then coming home from an experience where you were sexually assaulted for the first time, there's so many children, there were just so many layers of abuse and neglect there, but as a parent, I'm a parent now, I can tell when one little thing is off emotionally with my kids when they walk in the door. I'm very intuitive, right? They don't even have to look a certain way, you know, physically, I can just tell. But for you to walk in and present in that way, and then to be shut down when in that moment a child needs to be nurtured and heard and embraced and tended to. There are just so many layers. My heart's just bleeding for you. And then not to mention obviously everything else that you had brought up. And I think I don't really have a question, but just I think the last insight I have is just how amazing that you saw examples of what could be, not what, and so you knew that there was a better way, and you never gave up. You had a goal, and you just knew you had to survive, and you didn't give up, and you had hope. I just heard, you know, I hear even from an early age, as neglected and abused as you were, you had a hope, and you had goals. I think that's incredible. So those are just my comments. I don't really have any questions.
Thank you, Penelope, and you really connected with what I was saying, and thank you for your empathy and compassion, and I really appreciate that, and Yeah, that's why I like you guys.
You
get it.
You do. Unfortunately, we absolutely do. That's why I love this platform, of the shows, both Special Guest Night and Survivor Professional, because, what a gift to be able to not only tell your story, but to be understood in its words, within the content of its words. And I'm thankful for NASCA for that. So I actually have in the order in which the panel falls in. So, this is the order we'll go in. So, as I mentioned, Kim Lakin from Colorado and Bill Murray, our CEO and founder from NASCA, have called in. Richard from Texas has called in. And Carol, who's our NASCA vice president, New Jersey, has called in. So I'm going to now bring on Kim Lakin. And Kim, welcome this evening. Thanks for calling in. You're on with Holly.
Hey, thank you, Penelope. Hi, Holly.
Hi, Kim.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and just being so open and vulnerable. So, I think that we all can relate in some ways, like Penelope was saying, and, to certain aspects of your story. And I know kind of early on you were talking a little bit about your grandparents,
mm-hmm.
or your grandma, your grandmother, I think. How did she play a part in anything? I mean, was she ever questioning what was going on, like, in your family, or do you know?
Yes, I do know that. We lived in California, and so we would just go there. If my dad, because he was a teacher, we spent most of our summers there with them in Ely, Nevada. And I've shared this before, is that when we would go there, as I alluded to a little bit ago, it was one of our happier times, because with my grandparents, my parents were on their best behavior. Now my grandparents did drink more socially, although I don't remember my grandparents were quite a bit older for having my dad when they were much older. But anyway, my parents were on better behavior, on their best behavior, I'll put it that way. And then when my grandparents would come to visit us, it was the same thing. Much of that behavior was not being shown. In addition, my grandparents helped my parents financially, and so when we were at their house, things, of course, were a lot easier financially because they were paying for things and all of that. And so I think, I'm not excusing it, I'm just explaining that some of the stress that way was taken off. And then when they would come to visit us, which was usually at Christmas and maybe another holiday, they would help out financially. So there was at least this pretending to be better, being more present parents than, I just say, the wrong better behavior. That's how I explain it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, sometimes, I guess why I was just questioning, because there are sometimes that grandparents will really dig, especially if they can see what's going on, and then I feel like, for the most part, my grandparents were so in their addiction and stuff, kind of like your parents, it's just that they just were kind of blind to it. So I had a great grandmother that was questioning things here and there, but I didn't know that until I was an adult,
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I just kind of question that whenever somebody brings up the grandparents too, because I'm sure that, or I don't know, maybe not, but, it seems to me like maybe, especially with abuse going on, that they would have an idea, even if they're on their best behavior. You just always wonder what they really know. And so, but thank
yes.
you for sharing that.
Of course. Thank you. Yes.
And just for being so open, and I'm excited to hear the rest of your story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you so much. And I'm now going to Bill Murray, our CEO and founder of NASCA, on to the end of the conversation for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to support the show tonight. And I spoke to Holly just a short, well, I guess a couple of days ago, because I wasn't sure who was our guest, and I had to find her. she was there. I found her.
Thank you, Bill, finding me.
That's quite all right. Now, I have to say, I didn't realize that you were such a survivor, or else I might have written a little more in the introduction about that in the show description, and perhaps taken a couple of lines out about where you speak or something. But this is a powerful part of your story, so I don't want to hide it from anybody. This is what attracts people. You know, we're our ability to tell our story so honestly really impresses the newcomer, because they may be keeping it quiet and have done so for decades. Well, that's why we're here, to try and help people get into what we all refer to as recovery or the healing journey or whatever we want to call it. And so, I'm sorry, I apologize that I didn't say that. I did use the book titles in it, because they do talk about, daughters betrayed by their mothers is one, and breaking through betrayal is another, and so forth. So they do speak to some degree about survivorship. But the other thing I want to say is, you're also a professional. So we have this category of people amongst us who are hyphenates. We call them hyphenates, or I do. A hyphenate is a survivor who's also a professional. Now, they don't have to be a psychologist. In their professional life, they might be a minister, or they might be a law enforcement person, or they might be, it could be anything, and a survivor of child abuse. That's also very powerful, because the person can relate to both issues, both being a child abuse victim and being a professional in whatever capacity they're in. So we have a series of those on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I'd love to consider you possibly doing some of those shows for us at some point. But anyway, that's jumping ahead. I am really happy with your presentation, and I'm sure everybody else is too. I'll shut up now so you have plenty of time. But keep going and doing it quickly.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Thank you, Bill. Yes, I should mention that Bill is our show's producer as well. And he's I learned so much from Bill. He's done so many, and Carol, they've done so many of these shows. So I'm going to bring on Richard from Texas. Richard, you are on with Holly. Welcome this evening. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem. As Bill mentioned, I'm one of those lay counselors. I run a similar organization, and we do peer-led support groups and things like that. And my questions were, and first off, I have a comment, and if you'll indulge me, two technical questions. Would that be okay?
Okay. Sure.
So, all right. So, first off, I'm very sorry for what happened to you. I can only imagine your dismay and the feeling of betrayal when your mom told you to keep it to yourself. That's just horrifying to me. So I'm sorry that happened to you, and I believe you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The first question I had is, what worked for me, in my journey of healing, along with medication, what's been very effective for me is ego state therapy as both a primer and an adjunct to rapid eye movement. Did you have a professional opinion about that, and have you tried it?
Are you talking about EMDR?
Yeah, EMDR. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I have had training.
I'm sorry, I got that bad.
Oh, okay. I've gone to trainings, and I use a few of their techniques. So, yes, I'm familiar. I'm not certified in it. I use a different I have my kind of own. I developed this many, many years ago. I call it the Life Messages Exercise, and there's some components of it that have some similar components to EMDR. So the answer is yes, I'm familiar with it. I use some of their techniques, but I have my own tool for, it's a very safe tool for accessing trauma, and it's I don't use it all the time, but it is a way of gently being able to help a client, male or female or couples, navigate their trauma wounds.
Okay, great. Thank you. And the second question is...
Sorry, Richard. I'm so sorry. This is Penelope. This is not personal at all, but I become a little bit of a time lady, and I have to facilitate the show as well, as you very well know. But we're 48 minutes in, and I would like to break to the panel again and allow Holly to get to the middle segment of her story. I'm wondering if you would be okay with just saving that question for the next time I break, because I still have
Absolutely.
Are you okay? So it's not personal. It's just business.
No,
okay,
no.
So I
don't take it that way. It's all good.
Thank you so. Thank you so much. So appreciate you being on. So I will hold that for the next round, and I am going to bring Carol on. Carol, to ask a question or comment to Holly. Thanks for joining us, Carol.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I'm sorry I was late. My son is very sick. He was here for a little while and left with his wife to be operated on the 25th. But anyway, I don't know the gist of your whole story. I have what's in front of me. But breaking through betrayal, there are many of us who have been so horribly, horribly betrayed, you know, by our mothers. And that leaves a hole in our heart. It absolutely does. It doesn't matter how much, you know, I've worked all different places. I have a lot of training. But it's still in all, when your mother, that's much worse than if you're getting abused on the outside somehow. Because when your mother doesn't believe, which happened to me too, you and I have similarities here. My mother didn't believe that my brother was, she did believe it. She didn't care that my brother was assaulting me. Okay. So I fell on deaf ears. And that's something that that you do not forget. You don't forget any of your abuses, okay? You just simply don't. But when it's your mother, you know, that's I think that is the worst kind of abuse in a sense, you know, that people can, you know, hold on to if they do. And, of course, the idea is to move on, not to hold on to. But that's hard to get rid of, you know what I'm saying. So I've heard part of your story, and I saw some similarities like with mine, and I'm so sorry that you had to go through also to that, because that's something somehow you just don't quite forget. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to listen more to what you have to say and get a little more acquainted with your story. And then I'll have another question or a comment to make next time around, okay?
Okay, thank you so much, Carol, for sharing that. And I do, it resonates with me completely. Thank you.
No, you're quite welcome.
Thank you so much, Carol. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, Holly, I am I'm going to just turn it back over to you to pick up where we left off. And believe it or not, we're almost halfway through the show.
I know.
So let's go about, 15 minutes or so, and then I'll see if there's a point where we can break and go to the panel again, because I know that they're enjoying interacting with you.
You're okay with that. Oh, absolutely. And we're kind of going from 18 to 30. Is that correct?
Yeah, or a little, it's really up to you. But yeah.
Okay.
Roughly.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Penelope, because that's when I am talking about my, giving my story, depending on the time, this is how I break it up. So it's just like, wow, we were on the same page. So, yeah, this part of my life, I kind of call the brokenness from the traumatic background or traumatic experiences. Not that there wasn't brokenness before, as I described telling my story. I was repressing it. I was masking it. I was faking it. I did have quite a bit of anxiety and depression in high school, a little bit in middle school, but when I started menstruating, I just, and that's important for my story later, but it just really was exacerbated always around my cycle. And so I accomplished my goal. I graduated. I went away to University of California at Santa Barbara. I just had worked so hard. I'd gotten a full music scholarship to a conservatory in the town where my parents lived, the University of Pacific Conservatory of Music. And of course, they wanted me to take that, and it took such, full ride, but I would have had to live at home. We lived only about a half a mile from the university, and I just couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. And so I stood up to them because I had to go get away. That I had accomplished my goal, and so I went. Had to do a lot of it on my own, but that's okay. I went to UC Santa Barbara my freshman year. I was taking my classes and working hard, and a couple of things happened. A boyfriend that I'd had, that we just had a lovely relationship, he was at the University of Pacific, and he broke it off, and so I was sad about that because, I was 400 miles away, but he broke that off, and then I was in a music practice room with a piano partner. It was a flautist, but we had to take piano as well. And we were working on this duet together, and she exposed herself to me. And so that, given I had all this other repressed stuff going on, I remember just running out of that practice room and up to my dorm room. And that night, I cut my wrist. And I knew there were people close by. I didn't want to die, but I didn't know what to do. I just was in such a depression. And so a couple of gals on the floor and the RA found me right after I did it. And I was, of course, hospitalized on campus. And they wanted me to go home. And I just said, if I go home, I'll die. I will die. I won't make it. And so I agreed to go to counseling in Santa Barbara, which I did for that year. Now, I don't remember a lot of it, and we didn't do any of the deep work. But one of the interesting things, and it was a psychiatrist, but he did do some talk therapy. He just helped me manage, my thoughts and my feelings. He didn't put me on any medication, but just this one thing is that he taped my voice. He taped our sessions. He asked my permission at the beginning of that year, because this happened in the fall, and I went for a whole year. And at the end of the year, he was still taping, and he played back the sessions from the beginning. And this was important because I just felt this shift of hope inside of me, and I really enjoyed seeing him and going there. But when I heard my voice at the beginning and I heard my voice at the end, it was like two different people. And so it just really moved me and strengthened me. And again, I didn't get into any of the deep stuff, but it was a start. However, the brokenness continued to play out. Emotionally, I had no self-worth, self-esteem, no sense of belonging, acceptance, being loved, being lovable, being good enough. Psychologically, the bouts of depression and anxiety were increasing, and I would have these just anger just coming up from me, just rage that would boil up, and it just felt explosive at times. Like I didn't express it, but it just felt like I was going to blow up. Relationally is where I sought to get my needs met, and that was through men, and it was typically through unhealthy men. My boyfriend that I had in high school was a really good guy, but as I went through my college years, it was just one after the other of just really unhealthy. And of course, I didn't understand it then and why I was doing that. And my senior year, I studied abroad one year, but when I came back, I actually married an alcoholic. He was an assistant professor, much older than me, and it was just awful. It was horrible. We stayed married. We went abroad for a year, came back. And when we got back, I knew that I had to get out of that relationship and I had to be able to support myself. I had multiple affairs while I was married to him. He was off drunk most of the time, getting DUIs, court dates. It was horrible. He was also very abusive in our intimacy. And, of course, I was being triggered all over the place and didn't understand that. So I, again, thought to myself, I've got to get out of here. I've got to put a plan in place. So I went over to the college in the town that we were living. And with my degree, with my what I had my schooling in, the counselor said, the best thing for you to do is become a teacher. You can get that done in a year, year and a half. And so I did that and completed that credential and left him, divorced him. And then I got a job and was able to support myself. And I was married a second time, and he was a wonderful man, but he was broken from his past. I was broken from mine. And we ended up divorcing. And then I didn't really get any counseling until into my early 30s. I met my current husband, and he said, Holly, you know, there's something wrong here. He would see me being able to kind of take care of my emotions part of the month, and then the other part of the month, I was just always around my cycle, just really in deep depression, anxiety, and anger. Long story short, I found a wonderful doctor. Back then, disorder was not recognized. It was called PMS. It was mainly a joke back in the late 80s and early 90s. But this doctor, a female doctor, believed in it, assessed it, diagnosed it, treated it. And the important thing was for me, two things. One, she treated it through a holistic lens, mind, body, and spirit, through nutrition, exercise, stress reduction, all of that kind of thing. And then she said, you need to get some counseling. And so once again, I found a wonderful therapist. It was not, again, deep work, but I was really working on a lot of, you know, it was more cognitive behavioral therapy. And it was really helpful, working on my self-esteem and self-worth. And just I had really strong distortions about, not that they weren't based in truth, but she really worked well with me on changing some of the maladaptive behaviors that I had adopted in order to, you know, just kind of contain my life. And at that time, I had a daughter, a little girl, and it was so important to me to get well. I remembered that promise that I made. I never showed any of my depression or anxiety in front of her, but I wanted wellness so desperately. And at the end of that year, my husband and I, and I'll just finish up with this because this was important to my healing. At that time, we were living in a town not too far from my parents, from my family of origin. And my husband, Dan, and I made the decision to move to Southern California. And we did. We moved 500 miles away. We moved up into the mountains on 5 acres. And that really began, along with in-depth therapy, being in nature, getting some really qualified, trusted therapist. I started doing my deep work in my early 30s. That began the road of recovery for me.
Wow. You know, and just when you said you had met someone in terms of a provider that had some experience treating, you know, PMDD, the body, mind, you know, and spirit. It reminds me of what the, you know, how you address a soul injury, which I believe you had experienced many times over in your childhood, right? That body, mind, and spirit needing to be, and that really struck me. Wow.
One thing that was so wonderful, Penelope, is the counselor that I was seeing before we moved, she said, I can remember this as clear as day, so I said it's more cognitive behavioral therapy with her. She said, Holly, your healing work has just begun. know, don't be afraid, be brave. When you and Dan get relocated, there's a lot more there for you to uncover. And it was just so important. And, you know, she said it with compassion and care and concern. And that stayed with me because I knew, but I had repressed those, especially those two assaults, you know, those two at age 11 and 13, those were so buried. And, but I, it didn't leave me. I listened to her carefully and then began that work.
Did you feel overwhelmed that she also had stated that, you know, that you've done some work, but you've got some, a lot more work to do, basically? Did you,
you
have
know,
any sense of
overwhelmed? I felt that somebody understood me.
Yeah.
I thought somebody gets it. Somebody understands me. Somebody, and I trust, she was so wonderful, and I trusted her. You know, just to have this female that I trusted completely. It was interesting. That's a great question. I was like, okay, I trust her. She gets this. Something's there.
That's a gift. That's a gift. I feel that, you know, when you find someone that can help you and that, you know, and understands you, it's just like you've found an angel on this earth. And I know NASA is not a religious organization. That's my own in my department's right. There are angels on this earth, and you clearly found one.
Oh, I agree 1,000%.
Mm-hmm. And before I break to the panel, I do want to mention that I am very familiar with Ely, Nevada. My husband's father is from Ely, Nevada. So, and I'm also a California. Yeah. So I know.
Are you kidding?
I know, and a lot of people haven't heard of Ely, Nevada. When you say that, I thought, oh, I saw Ely, Nevada. And then also, I'm a California girl, so I know where UOP is. I almost went there, but I'm a UC girl. I went to UC Davis. All these places that you're mentioning, and obviously you're a very, very intelligent person because those are very hard schools in UC Santa Barbara to get into. Not only by bird, but also by location, right? By geography.
Yeah, because no one knows where Ely is.
I know. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Well, my father-in-law's from Ely, Nevada.
Thank you for sharing that. That's
great. You're welcome. You're welcome. So I'm actually now break to the panel, and I'm going to mention to the panel before I break. We are 32 minutes left in the show, so if you can please just keep your question or comment to about a minute with Holly, because I'd like to her to get to the love segment. There's so much that she's accomplished. And with that being said, I'm going to bring on Kim from Lakin, from Colorado. Kim, you're on with Holly.
Hey, thank you, Melody. Hi, Holly.
Hi.
Hey, I was just wondering, too, if there was any time throughout your childhood that, or in your, like your, mid or beginning adulthood, that you were introduced at all to a faith?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that last part.
Oh, to a faith? Like, did you ever go to a church, or did you ever go, you know, did anybody ever introduce you to?
No. That's a great, important, and it's an important question. My dad was an atheist. My mom, he would sometimes argue agnostic, but regardless. And then my mom was raised Mormon, but she says in her own words, she's no longer living, but she denounced that when she married my dad. We weren't allowed to go to church. There was no faith. There was no anything. When we were with my other grandparents, sometimes we would, Penelope, I don't know if you know where McGill is, but my mother was from McGill. I believe it's a little bit east of Ely. But anyway, they would take us to the Mormon church, but it seemed like a different world. Like we just weren't accustomed to any kind of faith. And, so the only time I heard God's name said was, you know, in vain. So no, I didn't have anything.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I just wonder sometimes, especially when it comes to wanting to be successful. You know, you talked about that early on you knew that you wanted to do something with your life, and so sometimes faith plays into that, and sometimes it doesn't. So I was just curious.
Yes.
So thank you so much. If I don't talk with you again, just thank you so much again for sharing. And I want to look you up. And are you on Facebook?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I am,
okay.
Kim. Thank you so much. I'm on Facebook, most of the social networking sites, you know, because that's what you have to do nowadays.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
well, thank you.
You
so much.
Thank you for
and
the
I'm
question.
I look forward to hearing the rest of your story.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you so much. I'm going to thank you, Kim, and I'm going to bring Bill back in. So, Bill, you are back on with Holly.
Well, I don't want to take a lot of time. I want to hear Richard's question, frankly.
Okay.
I'm going to give some time to him. But I just want to thank you. And you know, it's not a small thing that people like yourself put aside 90 minutes to give us your story. And, you know, we appreciate that. You're a member of the NASCA family now because you've done that. And, you know, we want you to engage however you'd like. That's Pamela, Penelope can describe that if she wishes to later. But thank you so much for being here. It's really great.
Oh, Bill, again, thank you so much. And for your warm welcome, as we were on Messenger on Facebook, I appreciated that and your warmth and your welcome spirit. So thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. And Richard, I'm going to bring you back on. I appreciate you hanging in there, and thank you. I've unmuted your mic, so you are on with Holly.
Okay. I'd like to also thank Bill for deferring his time to me. He's a gentleman. So my second question was, you know, doing advocacy work, you immediately notice, you know, that when a victim or survivor doesn't have help, that they tend to self-medicate with alcohol and drugs and such. And I've explored that a little bit more, and it was in my experience maybe it's anecdotal, but the, you know, clinical depression, anxiety, PTSD, sometimes dissociative disorder. And I flipped through to DSM, and it does a really good job of explaining these maladies. But it doesn't describe any cures for anything. So my question is this a condition that we're going to have the rest of our lives, and the best that we can do currently is successfully manage it?
Are you speaking about then our trauma, if we're able
yes.
to
mm-hmm.
address? Yes. Well, I've been doing this for about 25 years. I was a teacher first and then became a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I specialize in abuse and trauma, and in particular sexual abuse recovery. And it's not only my experience in my recovery, but it's also with my clients that I've worked with, is that there is healing. I come from this perspective that trauma is as, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Gabor Mate, but trauma is not what happens externally, but trauma is what goes on inside of us as a result of what happened to us. And so, and that's the experience I had when I was with my therapist, as I was working on my healing journey, is that with my clients, however it's manifesting, whether it's been in an addiction or, you know, whatever the different diagnoses might be, if it's not in my area of expertise, first of all, I refer that out. But depression, anxiety, PTSD, if people are active in their addiction, I do refer that out to a dual diagnosis, either a recovery center or such. But I really work on what I call peeling away those layers of outer shame, and which are self-blame, self-deprecation, all those life, I call them life messages that we say to ourselves about ourselves, the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions. And then peeling that away very gently, tenderly, slowly, till we get to the inner core of shame, which are those actual wounds. And it's hard work, and it's... it takes time, Mm-hmm. One of the things, and I don't want to use up too much, I'm looking at the time here too, but in my experience, to answer your question, it can be done, and it's ongoing, and it's depending on your triggers and your environment and your support system, and all. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a whole life way of living and integrating, like I said earlier, the mind, body, and the spirit pieces all together. And my wellness is my priority in life. It mm-hmm. was since I began and has continued to be, because I say we're only as good for others as we are to ourselves. So that I keep my pulse on consistently.
So would you consider yourself healed? Are you that far along in your journey?
I consider myself on the spectrum, and I would never say that I am healed, period. In 2015, my family went through a horrific trauma. I mean, horrific. I will just mention it because of the scale of it, and it speaks to what you're saying, is that my mom and dad were elderly. They were in their 80s. And they very methodically planned out, carried out, but did not complete a dual suicide. They did that on April 8th of 2015. Their bodies were found on April 10th, 2 days later. They were both barely alive. My dad was they were both hospitalized. My dad was in ICU, and then he wanted to pass at home, so he was released to go home and died under hospice care. My mother recovered and lived a few more years till 2019 in a assisted and then a nursing home. That trauma took me back a little bit, not necessarily a trigger, but the pain of all of those years and this feeling like, more around my father, because I'd already dealt with the betrayal around my mother, but my father and I had a close relationship, developed a close relationship in the latter part of his life, and I felt a betrayal by him doing that. So what did I need to do? I needed to go back, get into some therapy, tend to myself, you know, take care of that, and move forward. So for me, I would never say I was completely healed, because I look at it as just an ongoing journey, and I embrace it openly and welcome it. And I just keep, you know, we keep growing, we keep transforming, and we keep healing.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for your time, and thanks, Penelope, for being patient with us. Thank you.
Oh, of course. Thank you, Richard. That was a great question. And wow, Holly, thank you for sharing. For sharing that, not only your recent experience with your parents' attempted dual suicide, but also just I'm in this phase in my life. I'm 51, where I'm losing, I'm going blank, and I think it's a hormone thing, but we don't even talk about that right now. So sometimes I lose the words, but I know, not to mention Alzheimer's, but still know how to get home. Anyway, not to make light of those diseases, but, you know, just your position on healing as a continuum on a spectrum, because what Bill taught me, what NASCA, and you look on the NASCA website, which is nasca.org, it's a little plug here, but, you know, it's recovery, and recovery is a daily thing. Right.
Yes.
And I do like to look at it that way, because I don't set up myself up to think, well, I thought I was healed, but I guess I'm not. Right. So on the NASCA website, NASCA.org, I think you'll find that there is that motif of recovery as you go through our website and all the different. So sorry for my little digression on getting stuck on the word there, but, and I also want to thank you for being mindful of the time, because you're making my job so much easier, Holly. So thank you. But we have 20 minutes left, and I'd really like to give, you know, the lion's share of them to you, because we're in the third segment. You've done so much in terms of your professional accomplishments and your work. So I'm just going to give you the next, you know, 18, 19 minutes to take us into the third segment.
Okay, thank you so much, Penelope. I so appreciate it. one of the things that it both was a professional decision and also helped me in my healing. And by the way, I like to use recovery and put ing on the end, but all these verbs with ing because that means present tense. It's always ongoing. But anyway, digressed just a second. After I had several years of recovering under my belt and had done some of my deep work with my first therapist in Southern California, who was just amazing, and she was a hypnotherapist, and she helped me access that and heal those wounds around the trauma at age 13. But anyway, I had several years of healing under my belt, and I wanted to give back, and I wanted to help other women who were suffering from PMDD. Now, in the early 90s, there was a lot of good information coming out of other countries like Great Britain and even Italy, and there was a little bit in this country starting to, you know, to respect it as a disorder, a mood disorder that was based physiologically between the discrepancy between estrogen and progesterone in the body premenstrually. But there was a lot of really strange, weird stuff going on about it. So I started to lead these lay support groups actually at a church that my husband and I started attending, even though I had no faith growing up, which I talked about, but we started attending this church, and it was sort of progressive, and they welcomed me leading these groups. For 3 years, I led these groups. They were closed groups from about 10 to 15 women, and they ran about 12 weeks each. And I would no sooner finish a group, and then I'd have a waiting list to be in the next group. And they were psychoeducational. And at that time, I was also writing a book called The PMS Puzzle, Letting God Put the Pieces into Place, because there was nothing in the faith-based community that was addressing. I mean, I had women in this group tell me just, you know, they thought they were demon-possessed and just all these bizarre things. So I really wanted to, the knowledge that I had. And I did a ton of research right after I was, you know, diagnosed. So I led these groups for 3 years. And, of course, as we shared our suffering, we shared our healing, and I thought I was doing this for them, and it gave back to me. And I just had layers upon layers of healing. And so I knew I wanted to do something more professionally, and at least I had the common sense to refer women out to a wonderful doctor in the area that we live, and he could, if they had, you know, if they didn't have PMDD but had depression or anxiety or under, I could make sure that they got the help that they needed. But there was the impetus for me to go to graduate school and get my master's in psychology and then become a licensed marriage and family therapist. I knew that that was my calling. I wanted to do that. And so I did do that. And as I was doing that, I wrote this book, The PMS Puzzle, that was, it's psychoeducational and has a faith-based component to it, because there's a lot of other good books out there that don't have that. And it took me about a year. I kept getting turned down, but a publisher eventually picked it up, and it was published. And I just share that because I never, you know, I was a French and music major. I had to take bonehead English at UC Santa Barbara. I was never a writer. So anyway, I wrote it and got it published, and I started speaking a little bit, just a little bit, on PMS. And then so went to school, got the degree, got my license, and started working in the field as a marriage and family therapist. I was still teaching part-time. I'd put enough years in that I wanted to finish that, and so I could be in the California retirement system the way that it worked. I put in quite a few years already. But eventually, I went into my practice full-time. I worked at a counseling center, actually helped start a counseling center at the church we were attending, a faith-based counseling center that was open to all kinds of faith or no faith, it didn't matter, but we welcomed in all different kinds of faith. And I did that for 10 years, and I was able to finish my intern hours and then become licensed. Then I went into private practice, and that's when I really started specializing, getting more training in sexual abuse and trauma. And gosh, within a number of years, almost my entire practice was all sexual abuse and trauma, and about half of it was couples. And so I just found that, you know, I was good at it, and I had that background, so it just, you know, seemed to connect. And I had thought about betrayal, given, you know, that I'd had these experiences and started naming it as betrayal. And then when the economy shifted in our area we were living back in the 2006, 7, and 8, I had individuals coming in for therapy who were experiencing betrayal professionally, financially, relationally, you know, all different kinds. And the tools we were using at the time, I would consult with my colleagues and say, how are you addressing betrayal? Well, it's a loss issue. And I said, I understand that. It is. It's a loss of trust. It's a loss of relationship. But the grief methodologies that we have were just, I thought that there was something more. So I began researching betrayal. Different family member, there was a betrayal going on with me, and I just really paid attention to it. Nothing horrific, but just I thought, okay, I asked myself these three questions. What is betrayal? What are my clients feeling and why? And how long will they feel this way and why? And if I could figure that out, then I wanted to design and tailor a program specifically for betrayal recovery. And so, very long story short, it took me several years, but I did do that, based on client cases, not just around sexual abuse and trauma, but all kinds of betrayal, and discovered and uncovered some fascinating things around betrayal. So once I wrote the manuscript with the entire book, by this time, you know, of course, we've got This Is Back in 2008, so it's so much easier now that things are on computers and all of that. Publisher picked it up in about 8 weeks, Loving Healing Press out of Michigan. And I just say that because I've been with them ever since. And that book came out, the first edition of Breaking Through Betrayal. And because I belong to the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, there's 30 chapters in our state. We have state conferences. I began speaking. Now, this was important, Penelope, because remember, I'm getting my mouth washed out or peppered as a child. And even though I performed on my flute and piano, but mainly on my flute for years and competed and all of that, it wasn't my voice. You know, I kind of hid behind the flute or the piano. And so when I was asked to speak and started speaking, it was so hard. I was stuttering just thinking about it because I didn't think my voice was important that way. You know, I could write, I could work with clients, mm-hmm. but to speak publicly. So that was another part of my healing journey, and I don't want to take up too much more time in that. Anyway, I went on to write more books. Being a teacher, I was always just so, I always was an advocate of the underdog. I mean, if a kid was alone or picked on, I mean, I was right there by that kid's side. And so I taught middle school, then high school. I was very aware of bullying. Well, when cyberbullying came out, to me, whether it's bullying or cyberbullying, bullying is abuse. You know, we just give it a nice name, you know, or a palatable name mm-hmm. by saying it's bullying. Mm-hmm. It's abuse. It's peer-on-peer abuse. So I was on a mission. I became very involved with the anti-bullying movement with Stand for the Silent and Kirk Smalley. My husband and I were involved in that. I wrote a book on cyberbullying and started speaking on that. So it's always about finding and looking at issues where I want to look at causation and the causation around cyberbullying and then give folks tools to help protect, intervene, and prevent. I love that. That's your mission as well. So I do work in that area and in parenting. In 2000, 10, I finally, it's kind of interesting, it was much later in life, addressed the other trauma at age 11. It just took so many years to get that wound addressed. And I did, and then I wrote my memoir called Mountain Air, Relapsing and Finding the Way Back, One Breath at a Time. Because I had over 20 some odd years of recovering and healing under my belt, and for reasons that are too long to explain, my husband and I moved back to our what I call my betrayal environment for a few years. And within a few nights, not in the same town, but nearby, I was right back into that role of the people pleaser, peacemaker. I was so disappointed in myself. And so all of that to say, we moved back to Southern California again. And but I had, that experience was so important, because much as I thought that I understood relapse, until whether it's an addiction or a behavior or a relationship or whatever it might be, is that I didn't get it until I relapsed into my codependent nature and all the shame and everything that came along with that. So I wrote Mountain Air, and that memoir that has healing tools in it. Everything I write has healing stuff in it. And then we came out with a second edition of Breaking Through Betrayal, because I wanted to write, we added, I say we, my publisher, but we added a section at the end called Relapse from Self-Betrayal to Self-Discovery, because there's so many incredible things we can learn from when we have a relapse. So I look at it as really an opportunity for more healing and growth. I want to disclose, even though I've written a couple other books, but my most difficult project was when I embarked upon The Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers, Moving from Brokenness to Wholeness. I spent 2 years interviewing daughters. There's my stories in there along with six other daughters who, it was a qualitative study, and it's all spelled out in the book what I did, but all that to say is it didn't matter to me what their healing journeys were, but I wanted to find out from other daughters what their journeys were. And so in order to be in the study, you had to be able to delineate what your healing journey was. And I knew in order to go through the difficult process of the interviews that I conducted, the daughters would need to have some pretty strong and secure healing underneath their belt. And so that book came out in February of 2018, and I share this just because all I care about, Penelope and team and staff, is reaching other people. That's my purpose. That's my passion. It has been in and out of the top 100 consistently on Amazon and Recovery ACOA and ACOA Adult Children of Alcoholics consistently for over 3 years. And the letters, the messages, the emails that I get from all over the country is absolutely heartwarming and heartbreaking. And I just want to share one example, and then I'll be done. Is about a month ago, probably 5 weeks or so at this point in time, is that I got two messages in one day. One was from a young female, 26-year-old female from Florida, mother of six-year-old twins. She had been given a copy of the audiobook, and she listened to it. She was getting ready to take her life. And through those stories of shared suffering and shared healing, she didn't. And her note to me, I lost it when I read it, that she, not to be alone, is what kept her from doing that. That same day, a message from another young female out of Georgia whose therapist gave her a copy of it. And she said from reading that book that she really needed to go into inpatient treatment. I don't know what all of the issues were, but that motivated her to make that decision to go into inpatient treatment. So that's a lot. Thank you for listening to all of that. This is what I do. It's how, it's as you've talked about, it's about helping others. It's not about me. It's about reaching out and helping anyone shorten their stay in their pain field. If I can do that, then I'm a happy girl.
You've done it. I mean, and I know you continue to do it. You have done it. Wow. I mean, just wow. You are amazing. I'm sure everybody's thinking that. I know everybody's thinking that. I'm just going to say it. You're amazing. I mean, you are. I mean, you are. Just your testimony and your accomplishment. You just can do whatever you set your mind to. And you, I can hear. I can. From what you've relayed in terms of even what you've done yourself and what you tell your patients. You know, even a relapse is an opportunity to learn something and to keep moving forward. You know, you have, you embody hope, you know, hope. And it just seems like there's nothing you can't do. I really appreciate you sharing all of your, you know, all of your books, well, some of your books with us. But, you know, and at NASA we do have on the website, we have a lot of authors that are members of NASCA, and the books are listed. And so that is a way for you to also, if they're not a member of the family of the NASCA family, to get your books on our website. And I can just tell you, you know, the moment I read your bio, I'm going to buy Daughters Betrayed by Their Mothers, Moving from Brokenness to Wholeness. You know, I echo Carol's sentiments. That leaves a very big hole. So thank you for that.
You're so welcome, and thank you, Penelope.
Absolutely. And I know, I just want to let, I know our panel is aware of this, but also those who are streaming and listening or who may stream them later. When you click on the hyperlink to scan number 2726, Holly's name, if you just, it's in a different color because it's actually hyperlinked to her face, find her on Facebook. Under her bio are a lot of the titles of the books that she's alluded to that she's written. So actually there's a hyperlink to author of multiple books. It goes on to Amazon and it has your picture. You can follow Holly on Amazon and it actually lists all the books that you've written. So you are... our listeners can find you on Amazon. And I don't know if there's another way for, if some of our listening audience wants to get a hold of you, another way to get a hold of you. Those are just a few, so I'll just give you the last minute to mention other ways to get a hold of you, and then just do this with a few words, and I'll close out the show.
Okay, thank you, Penelope, so much. If they want to contact me, they can do that through my website. It's my name, Holly with an I. It's just www.hollykenley.com. There is a contact. I welcome emails. I welcome connecting with you. I'm also on most of the Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you know, all of that. So I would love to connect with you. And I think I would just leave with this quote that is at the beginning of the Daughters, I call it the Daughters book, and it's a very famous quote by Stefan Hohler, and it says, "A pearl is a beautiful thing produced by an injured life." And I truly believe that. That's the hope and the healing of we're doing our work. And there's so many pearls out there who have been injured. I know that. You guys know that. It's part of who we are, and yet we are meant to shine and live our lives to the fullest. So I just encourage you on your journeys and, just sending out love and light to you.
Oh, what a beautiful sentiment. Thank you, Holly. I wish to thank Holly Kemry for being our very special guest on the show this evening, and we welcome her to the NASCA family. I'd also like to thank Kim Lakin from Colorado, Richard from Texas, Bill Murray, our CEO and founder, and Carol Levine, our Vice President of NASCA, for joining the panel this evening. Everybody listening in, and again, please visit NASCA.org. That's NAASCA.org. And check out our website. There are a lot of resources on there for you to utilize. And with that being said, I'm going to close out the show. All of our responsibility to prevent child abuse. So if you see something, please say something. Thank you for listening. and good night.
You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Talk Radio.